Not to my knowledge. You didn't inform him of my departure? You don't understand, he said. I wasn't aware of your having been away, until you activated me a moment ago. But you've been recording. Yes, but not aware of it. I'm only here when you activate me. Then I evaluate the current data. One thing you can be fairly certain of, though, is that it simply isn't possible to broadcast any sort of signal from this house without Swain Snoops detecting it immediately. Could there be more of you? I mean, another one in the same unit? Interesting idea, but no, barring some harrowing secret breakthrough in technology. I'm pushing the current envelope a bit as it is, considering the size of my hardware. I know that from my store of general background information. She looked down at the unit in her hand.
Lania, she said, tell me.
10:25:16 a.m., he said. Her head filled with disembodied voices.
If you follow me, please, sir. Come into the billiard room.
You'd better have a reason for this, Swain. There are 3 net men waiting in the car. Security will have your address in their database until hell freezes over.
Lovely car that is, sir. The Daimler. Take your coat.
What is it, Swain? Why couldn't we meet at Brown's?
Take off your coat, Robin. She's gone.
Gone?
To the sprawl. Early this morning.
But it isn't time.
You think I sent her there?
The man's reply was hollow, indistinct, lost behind a closing door.
That was Lania?
Kumiko asked silently. Yes, Colin replied. Patel mentioned him by name in an earlier conversation. Swain and Lania spent 25 minutes together. Sound of a latch. Movement.
Bloody cock-up, not mine. I warned you about her. Told you to warn them.
Born killer. Probably psychopathic.
And your problem, not mine. You need their product and my cooperation.
And what's your problem, Lania? Why are you in this? Just to get Mitchell out of the way?
Where's my coat?
Petal? Mr. Lanier's bloody coat. Sir!
I have the impression they want your razor girl as badly as they want Angie. She's definitely part of the payoff.
They'll be taking her, too.
Good luck to them, then.
She's already in position in the sprawl. Spoke with her on the phone an hour ago.
I'll be putting her together with my man over there, the one who's been arranging for the girl. And you'll be going back over yourself?
This evening.
Well, then, not to worry.
Goodbye, Swain.
He's a right bastard, that one.
I don't like this. Really.
You like the goods, though, don't you?
Can't complain there, but...
Why do you think they want Sally as well? Cross knows. They're welcome to her.
They. I don't like theys.
They mightn't be terribly happy to know she'd gone there on her own stick with Yanaka's daughter.
No.
But we have Miss Yanaka back again. Tomorrow I'll tell Sally that Pryor's in Baltimore, getting the girl into shape. That's an ugly business, that is.
Bring a pot of coffee to the study. She lay on her back, eyes closed. Colin's recordings unspooling in her head. Direct input to the auditory nerves.
Swain seemed to conduct the better part of his dealings in the billiard room, which meant that she heard people arriving and departing, heads and tails of conversations. 2 men, one of whom might have been the red-faced man, held an interminable discussion of dog racing and tomorrow's odds.
She listened with special interest as Swain and the man from Special Branch, S.B., Swain called it, settled an article of business directly beneath the marble bust as the man was preparing to leave. She interrupted the segment half a dozen times to request clarification. Colin made educated guesses.
"This is a very corrupt country,"
she said at last, deeply shocked. "Perhaps no more than your own," he said.
"But what is Swain paying these people with?"
"Information?"
"I would say that our Mr. Swain has recently come into possession of a very high-grade source of intelligence, and is busy converting it into power. On the basis of what we've heard, I'd hazard that this has probably been his line of work for some time. What's apparent, though, is that he's moving up, getting bigger. There's internal evidence that he's currently a much more important man than he was a week ago. Also, we have the fact of the expanded staff.
I must tell my friend."
"Shears? Tell her what?"
"What Lanier said. That she would be taken, along with Angela Mitchell."
"Where is she, then?"
"The Sprawl. A hotel."
"Phone her. But not from here."
"Do you have money?" "A Mitsu bank chip."
"No good in our phone, sorry. Have any coin?" She got up from the bed and sorted carefully through the odd bits of English money that had accumulated at the bottom of her purse.
"Here,"
she said, coming up with a thick gilt coin.
£10.
"Need two of those to make a local call." She tossed the brassy tenner back into her purse.
"No, Colin, not the phone. I know a better way. I want to leave here. Now, today. Will you help me?"
"Certainly," he said. "Though I advise you not to."
"But I will."
"Very well. How do you propose to go about it?"
"I'll tell them," she said, "that I need to go shopping."
Chapter 27. Bad Lady. The woman must have gotten in sometime after midnight, she figured later. Because it was after Pryor came back with the crabs, the second bag of crabs. They really did have some good crabs in Baltimore. And, coming off a run, always gave her an appetite. So she'd talked him into going back for some more. Gerald kept coming in to change the derms in her arms. She'd give him her best goofy smile every time, squish the trank out of them when he'd gone, and then stick them back on. Finally, Gerald said she should get some sleep. He put out the lights and turned down the fake window to its lowest setting, a blood-red sunset. When she was alone again, she slid her hand between the bed and the wall, found the shock rod in its hole in the foam. She fell asleep without meaning to. The red glow of the window like a sunset in Miami. And she must have dreamed of Eddie, or any way of Hooky Greens. Dancing with somebody up there on the 33rd floor. Because when the crash woke her, she wasn't sure where she was. But she had this very clear map of the way out of Hooky Greens. Like she knew she'd better take the stairs because there must be some kind of trouble. She was halfway out of bed when Pryor came through the door. Like, really through it. Because it was still shut when he hit it. He came through it backward, and it just went to splinters and honeycomb chunks of cardboard. She saw him hit the wall, and then the floor, and then he wasn't moving anymore. And someone else was there in the doorway, backlit from the other room, and all she could see of the face were these two curves of reflected red light from that fake sunset. Pulled her legs back into bed and sank back against the wall, her hand sliding down to, "Don't move, bitch." There was something real scary about that voice, because it was too fucking cheerful, like throwing Pryor through that door had been a kind of a treat.
I mean, really, don't move.
And the woman was across the room in three strides, very close, so close that Mona felt the cold coming off the leather of the woman's jacket.
Okay, Mona said. Okay.
Then hands grabbed her, fast, and she was flat on her back, shoulders pressed down hard into the foam, and something, the shock rod, was right in front of her face.
Where'd you get this little thing?
Oh,
Mona said, like it was something she might have seen once but forgotten about.
It was in my boyfriend's jacket. I borrowed his jacket.
Mona's heart was pounding. There was something about those glasses.
Did Shithead know you had this little thing? Who? Pryor,
the woman said, and let go of her, turning. Then she was kicking him, kicking Pryor over and over, hard.
No,
she said, stopping as abruptly as she'd begun.
I don't think Pryor knew.
Then Gerald was in the doorway, just like nothing had happened, except he was looking ruefully at the part of the door that was still in the frame, rubbing his thumb over an edge of splintered laminate.
Coffee, Molly?
Two coffees, Gerald,
the woman said, examining the shock rod.
Mine's black.
Mona sipped her coffee and studied the woman's clothes and hair while they waited for Pryor to wake up. At least, that's what they seemed to be doing. Gerald was gone again. She wasn't much like anybody Mona'd seen before. Mona couldn't place her on the style map at all, except she must have had some money. The hair was European. Mona had seen it like that in a magazine. She was pretty sure it wasn't this season's style anywhere, but it went okay with the glasses, which were insets, planted right in the skin. Mona had seen a cabbie in Cleveland had those. And she wore this short jacket, very dark brown, too plain for Mona's taste, but obviously new, with a big white sheepskin collar, open now over a weird green thing trussed across her breasts and stomach like armor, which was what Mona figured it probably was, and jeans cut from some kind of gray-green mossy suede, thick and soft. And Mona thought they were the best thing about her outfit. She could have gone for a pair of those herself, except the boots spoiled them. These knee-high black boots, the kind bike racers wore, with thick yellow rubber soles and big straps across the insteps. Chrome buckles all up and down, horrible, clunky toes. And where'd she get that nail color, that burgundy? Mona didn't think they even made that anymore.
What the hell are you looking at? Your boots.
So?
They don't make it with your pants.
Wore 'em to kick the shit out of Pryor.
Pryor moaned on the floor and started trying to throw up. It made Mona feel kind of sick herself, so she said she was going to go to the bathroom.
Don't try to leave.
The woman seemed to be watching Pryor, over the rim of her white china cup. But with those glasses, it was hard to be sure. Somehow she found herself in the bathroom with her purse on her lap. She hurried, getting the hit together. Didn't grind it fine enough, so it burned the back of her throat. But like Lynette used to say, you don't always have time for the niceties.
And anyway, wasn't that all a lot better now?
There was a little shower in Gerald's bathroom, but it looked like it hadn't been used for a long time. She took a closer look and saw gray mold growing around the drain and spots that looked like dried blood. When she came back, the woman was dragging Pryor into one of the other rooms, pulling him by his feet. He had socks on, no shoes. Mona noticed now, like maybe he'd had his feet up to sleep. His blue shirt had blood on it, and his face was all bruised. What Mona felt as the rush kicked in was a bright and innocent curiosity.
What are you doing?
I think I'll have to wake him up,
the woman said, like she was on the subway, talking about another passenger who was about to miss his stop. Mona followed her into the room where Gerald did his work, everything clean and hospital white. She watched as the woman got Pryor up into a sort of chair like in a salon, with levers and buttons and things.
It isn't like she's that strong, Mona thought. It's like she knows which way to throw the weight.
Pryor's head fell to the side as the woman fastened a black strap across his chest. Mona was starting to feel sorry for him, but then she remembered Eddie.
What is it?
The woman was filling a white plastic container with water from a chrome tap. Mona just kept trying to say it, feeling her heart race out of control on the whiz.
He killed Eddie, she kept trying to say, but it wouldn't come out.
But then it must have, because the woman said,
Yeah, he'll do that sort of thing.
If you let him. She threw the water over Pryor, into his face and all down his shirt. His eyes snapped open, and the white of the left one was solid red. The metal prongs of the shock rod snapped white sparks when the woman pressed it against the wet blue shirt. Pryor screamed. Gerald had to get down on his hands and knees to pull her out from under the bed. He had cool, very gentle hands. She couldn't remember how she'd gotten under there, but now everything was quiet. Gerald had on a gray topcoat and dark glasses.
You're going with Molly now, Mona, he said.
She started to shake.
I think I'd better give you something for your nerves.
She jerked back out of his grip. No, don't fucking touch me!
Leave it, Gerald,
the woman said from the door.
It's time you go now.
I don't think you know what you're doing, he said. But good luck.
Thanks.
Think you'll miss the place?
No, I was going to retire soon anyway.
So was I, the woman said. And then Gerald left, without even a nod for Mona. Got any clothes? The woman asked Mona. Get them on. We're leaving too. Dressing, Mona found she couldn't button her dress over her new breasts, so she left it open, putting Michael's jacket on and zipping it up to her chin. Chapter 28 Company.
Sometimes he just needed to stand there and look up at the judge, or squat on the concrete beside the witch. It held back the memory stutter, to do that. Not the fugues, the real flashbacks, but this jerky, unfocused feeling he got, like the memory tape kept slipping in his head, losing minute increments of experience. So he was doing that now, and it was working. And finally he noticed Cherry was there beside him. Gentry was up in the loft with the shape he'd captured, what he called a macroform node. And he'd hardly listened to what Slick had tried to tell him about the house and that whole place, and Bobby the Count. So Slick had come down here to crouch next to an investigator in the cold and dark, retracing all the things he'd done with so many different tools and where he'd scrounged each part. And then Cherry reached out and touched his cheek with her cold hand.
You okay?
She asked.
I thought maybe it was happening to you again.
No, it's just I gotta come down here sometimes.
He plugged you into the Count's box, didn't he?
Bobby, Slick said. That's his name. I saw him.
Where?
In there. It's a whole world. There's this house, like a castle or something, and he's there.
By himself?
He said Angie Mitchell is in there, too.
Maybe he's crazy. Is she?
I didn't see her,
saw a car he said was hers.
She's in some celebrity detox place in Jamaica, last I heard.
He shrugged.
I don't know.
What's he like?
He looked younger. Anybody'd look bad with all those tubes and shit in them. He figured Kid Africa dumped him here because he got scared. He said if anybody comes looking for him, we jack him into the Matrix.
Why?
Dunno.
You should have asked him.
He shrugged again.
Seen Bird anywhere?
No.
Should have been back already.
He stood up. Little Bird came back at dusk on Gentry's bike, the dark wings of his hair damp with snow and flapping behind him as he roared in across the solitude. Slick winced. Little Bird was in the wrong gear. Little Bird jolted up an incline of compacted oil drums and hit the brakes when he should have gunned it. Cherry gasped as Bird and the bike separated in midair. The bike seemed to hang there for a second before it somersaulted into the rusted sheet metal tangle that had been one of factory's outbuildings, and Little Bird was rolling over and over on the ground. Somehow Slick never heard the crash. He was standing beside Cherry in the shelter of a doorless loading bay. Then he was sprinting across snow-flecked rust to the fallen rider, no transition. Little Bird lay on his back with blood on his lips, his mouth partially hidden by the jumble of thongs and amulets he wore around his neck.
"Don't touch him," Cherry said. "Ribs may be broken, or he's mashed up inside."
Little Bird's eyes opened at the sound of her voice. He pursed his lips and spat blood and part of a tooth.
"Don't move," Cherry said, kneeling beside him and switching to the crisp diction she'd learned in med tech school. "You may have been injured."
"Fuck it, lady,"
he managed, and struggled stiffly up, with Slick's help.
"All right, asshole," she said. "Hemorrhage. See if I give a shit."
"Didn't get it,"
Little Bird said, smearing blood across his face with the back of his hand.
"The truck."
"I can see that," Slick said.
"Mavi and them, they got company. Like flies on shit. Couple of hovers and a copter and shit. All these guys."
"What kind of guys?"
"Like soldiers, but they're not. Soldier'll goof around, bullshit, crack jokes when nobody important's looking. But not them."
"Cops?"
Marvy and his two brothers grew mutant ruderalis in a dozen half-buried railway tank cars. Sometimes they tried to cook primitive amine compounds, but their lab kept blowing up. They were the nearest thing factory had to permanent neighbors. 6 kilometers.
"Cops?"
Little Bird spat another tooth chip and gingerly probed his mouth with a bloody finger.
"They aren't doing anything against the law. Anyway, cops can't afford shit like that. New hovers, new Honda."
He grinned through a film of blood and spittle.
"I hung off in the solitude and scoped him good. Nobody I'd want to talk to, or you either. Guess I really fucked Gentry's bike, huh?"
"Don't worry about it," Slick said. "I think his mind's on something else."
"That's good."
He staggered in the direction of factory, nearly fell, caught himself, continued.
"He's hiring a kite," Cherry said.
"Hey, Bird," Slick called. "What happened to that bag of shit I gave you to give Marvy?"
Bird swayed, turned.
"Lost it."
Then he was gone, around a corner of corrugated steel.
"Maybe he's making that up," Cherry said. "About those guys. Or seeing things."
"I doubt it,"
Slick said, pulling her into deeper shadow as an unlit black Honda swung down toward factory out of winter twilight.
He heard the Honda making its fifth pass over factory as he pounded up the quaking stairs, the iron roof rattling with the copter's passage.
Well, he thought, that should anyway bring into Gentry's attention that they had visitors. He took the fragile catwalk in 10 long, slow steps.
He was beginning to wonder if they'd ever be able to get the Count and his stretcher back out without having to weld an extra eye bar across the span. He went into the bright loft without knocking. Gentry was sitting at a workbench, his head cocked to one side, staring up at the plastic skylights. The bench was littered with bits of hardware and small tools.
"Helicopter," Slick said, panting from the climb. "Helicopter,"
Gentry agreed, nodding thoughtfully, his disheveled rooster tail bobbing.
"They seem to be looking for something." "I think they just found it. Could be the Fission Authority."
"Bird saw people at Marvie's, saw that copter there, too. You weren't paying much attention when I tried to tell you what he said."
"Bird?"
Gentry looked down at the small bright things on the workbench, picked up two fittings and twisted them together.
"The Count! He told me!"
"Bobby Newmark," Gentry said.
"Yes? I know a lot more about Bobby Newmark now."
Cherry came in behind Slick.
"You gotta do something about that bridge," she said, going immediately to the stretcher. "It shakes too much."
She bent to check the Count's readouts.
"Come here, Slick,"
Gentry said, standing. He walked to the hollow table. Slick followed, looking at the image that glowed there. It reminded him of the rugs he'd seen in the gray house, patterns like that, only these were woven of hair-fine neon and twisted into some kind of infinite knot. The knot's core hurt his head to look at. He looked away.
"That's it?"
he asked Gentry.
"What you've always been looking for?" "No, I told you. This is just a node, a macro form, a model."
"He's got this house in there like a castle and grass and trees and sky.
He's got a lot more than that. He's got a universe more than that. That was just a construct worked up from a commercial stim. What he's got is an abstract of the sum total of data constituting cyberspace."
"Still, it's closer than I've gotten before."
"He didn't tell you why he was in there?"
"Didn't ask him."
"Then you'll have to go back."
"Hey, Gentry, listen up. That copter, it'll be back. It'll be back with two hovers full of guys Bird said looked like soldiers.
They aren't after us, man. They're after him."
"Maybe they're his. Maybe they are after us."
"No! He told me, man! He said anybody comes looking for him, we're in deep shit, and we gotta jack him into the Matrix."
Gentry looked down at the little coupling he still held.
"We'll talk with him, Slick.
You'll go back. This time, I'll go with you."
Chapter 29 Winter Journey. Petal had agreed finally, but only after she'd suggested phoning her father for permission. That had sent him shuffling unhappily off in search of Swain, and when he'd returned, looking no happier, the answer had been yes. Bundled in several layers of her warmest clothing, she stood in the white-painted foyer, studying the hunting prints while Petal lectured the red-faced man, whose name was Dick, behind closed doors. She couldn't distinguish individual words, only a low torrent of admonition. The Moss Neotech unit was in her pocket, but she avoided touching it. Twice already, Colin had tried to dissuade her. Now Dick emerged from Petal's lecture, with his hard little mouth set in a smile.
Under his tight black suit, he wore a pink cashmere turtleneck and a thin gray lamb's wool cardigan. His black hair was plastered tightly back against his skull. His pale cheeks were shadowed by a few hours' growth of beard. She palmed the unit in her pocket.
"Lau,"
Dick said, looking her up and down.
"Where shall we go for our walk?"
"Portobello Road," Colin said, slouched against the wall beside the crowded coat rack. Dick took a dark overcoat from the rack, reaching through Colin to do it, put it on and buttoned it. He pulled on a bulky pair of black leather gloves.
"Portobello Road,"
Kumiko said, releasing the unit.
"How long have you worked for Mr. Suane?"
she asked, as they made their way along the icy pavement of the crescent.
"Long enough," he replied. "Mind you don't slip. Wicked heels on those boots."
Kumiko tottered along beside him on black French patent spikes. As she'd predicted, it was virtually impossible to navigate the glass-hard, rippled patches of ice in these boots. She took his hand for support. Doing this, she felt solid metal across his palm. The gloves were weighted, the fingers reinforced with carbon mesh. He was silent as they turned the side street at the end of the crescent, but when they reached Portobello Road, he paused.
"Excuse me, miss,"
he said, a note of hesitation in his voice.
"But is it true what the boys say?"
"Boys? Excuse me?"
"Swain's boys, his regulars. That you're the big fellow's daughter. The big fellow back in Tokyo."
"I'm sorry," she said. "I don't understand."
"Yanaka. Your name's Yanaka."
"Kumiko Yanaka, yes."
He peered at her with intense curiosity. Then worry crossed his face, and he glanced carefully around.
"Lord," he said, "must be true."
His squat, tightly buttoned body was taut and alert.
"Governor said you wanted a shop."
"Yes, thank you."
"Where shall I take you?"
"Here,"
she said, and led him into a narrow arcade lined solidly with British gomi. Her Shinjuku shopping expeditions served her well with Dick. The techniques she devised for torturing her father's secretaries proved just as effective now, as she forced the man to participate in dozens of pointless choices between one Edwardian medallion and another, this or that fragment of stained glass, though she was careful only to choose items, finally, that were fragile or very heavy, awkward to carry, and extremely expensive. A cheerful bilingual shop assistant accessed an £80,000 charge against Kumiko's Mitsu Bank chip. Kumiko slipped her hand into the pocket that held the Mas Neotech unit.
"Exquisite,"
the English girl said in Japanese, as she wrapped Kumiko's purchase, an ormolu vase encrusted with griffins.
"Hideous," Colin commented in Japanese. "An imitation as well."
He reclined on a Victorian horsehair sofa, his boots up on an Art Deco cocktail stand, supported by Airstream aluminum angels. The shop assistant added the wrapped vase to Dick's burden. This was Dick's 11th antique shop and Kumiko's 8th purchase.
"I think you'd better make your move,"
Colin advised.
"Any moment now, our Dick will buzz Swain's for a car to take that lot home." "Think this is it, then?"
Dick asked, hopefully, over Kumiko's purchases.
"One more shot, please."
Kumiko smiled.
"Right,"
he said grimly. As he was following her out the door, she drove the heel of her left boot into a gap in the pavement she'd noticed on her way in.
"You all right?"
he asked, seeing her stumble.
"I've broken the heel of my boot."
She hobbled back into the shop and sat down beside Colin on the horsehair sofa. The assistant came fussing up to help.
"Get him off quick,"
Colin advised, "before Dickie puts his parcels down." She unzipped the boot with the broken heel, then the other, pulled off both. In place of the coarse Chinese silk she usually wore in winter, her feet were sheathed in thin black rubber toe socks with ridged plastic soles. She nearly ran between Dick's legs as she cleared the door, but instead, her shoulder struck his thigh as she squeezed past, toppling him into a display of faceted crystal decanters. And then, she was free, plunging through the press of tourists down Portobello Road. Her feet were very cold, but the ridged plastic soles provided excellent traction. Though not on ice, she reminded herself, picking herself up from her second spill, wet grit against her palms. Colin had directed her down this narrow passage of blackened brick. She grasped the unit.
"Where next?"
"This way," he said. "I want the rose and crown," she reminded him.
"You want to be careful. Dick, you'll have Swain's men here by now, not to mention the sort of hunt that friend of Swain's from Special Branch could mount if he's asked to, and I can't imagine why he shouldn't be asked to."
She entered the Rose and Crown by a side door, Colin at her elbow, grateful for the snug gloom and irradiating warmth that seemed central to the idea of these drinking burrows. She was struck by the amount of padding on the walls and seats, by the muffling curtains. If the colors and fabrics had been less dingy, the effect would somehow have been less warm. Pubs, she guessed, were an extreme expression of the British attitude toward gomi. At Colin's urging, she made her way through the drinkers clustered in front of the bar, hoping to find Tick.
"What'll it be, dear?"
She looked up into the broad blonde face behind the bar, bright lipstick and rouged cheeks.
"Excuse me," Kumiko began. "I wish to speak with Mr. Bevan."
"Mine's a pint, Alice," someone said, slapping down 3 10-pound coins. "Lager."
Alice worked a tall white ceramic lever, filling a mug with pale beer. She put the mug on the scarred bar and swept the money into a rattling till behind the counter.
"Someone wanting a word, Bevan,"
Alice said as the man lifted his pint. Kumiko looked up at a flushed, seamed face. The man's upper lip was short. Kumiko thought of rabbits, though Bevan was large, nearly as large as Petal. He had a rabbit's eyes as well, round, brown, showing very little white.
"With me?"
His accent reminded her of Tick's.
"Tell him yes," Colin said. "He can't think why a little Jap girl in rubber socks has come into the drinker looking for him." "I wish to find Tick."
Bevan regarded her neutrally over the rim of his raised pint.
"Sorry,"
he said.
"Can't say I knew anyone by that name."
He drank.
"Sally told me I should find you if Tick wasn't here. Sally Shears."
Bevan choked on his lager, his eyes showing a fraction of white.
Coughing,
he set the mug on the bar and took a handkerchief from his overcoat pocket. He blew his nose and wiped his mouth.
"I'm on duty in 5, he said. "Best step in the back."
Alice raised a hinged section of the bar. Bevan ushered Kumiko through with small flapping motions of his large hands, glancing quickly over his shoulder. He guided her down a narrow passage that opened off the area behind the bar. The walls were brick, old and uneven, thickly coated with dirty green paint. He stopped beside a battered steel hamper heaped with terry bar towels that reeked of beer.
"You'll regret it if you're on a con girl," he said. "Tell me why you're looking for this Tick."
"Sally is in danger. I must find Tick. I must tell him."
"Fucking hell,"
the barman said.
"Put yourself in my position."
Colin wrinkled his nose at the hamper of sodden towels.
"Yes?"
Kumiko said.
"If you're a narc, and I sent you to find this Tick fella, assuming I did know him, and he's on some sort of black, then he'd do for me, wouldn't he?" But if you're not, then this Sally, she'd likely do for me if I don't understand.
Kumiko nodded.
Between the rock and the hard place.
It was an idiom Sally had used. Kumiko found it very poetic.
Quiet,
Bevan said, giving her an odd look.
Help me. She is in very great danger.
He ran his palm back across thinning ginger-colored hair.
You will help me,
she heard herself say, feeling her mother's cold mask click into place.
Tell me where to find Tick.
The barman seemed to shiver. Though it was overly warm in the passageway, a steamy warmth, beer smell mingling with raw notes of disinfectant.
Do you know London?
Colin winked at her.
I can find my way, she said.
Bevan!
Alice said, putting her head around the corner.
The filth!
Police,
Colin translated.
Margate Road, SW2, Bevan said. Don't know the number, don't know his phone. Let him show you out the back now,
Colin said.
Those are no ordinary policemen.
Kumiko would always remember her endless ride through the city's underground. How Colin led her from the Rose and Crown to Holland Park and down, explaining that her Mitsu Bank chip was worse than useless now. If she used it for a cab or any sort of purchase, he said, some special branch operator would see the transaction flare like magnesium on the grid of cyberspace. But she had to find Tick, she told him. She had to find Margate Road. He frowned. No, he said. Wait till dark. Brixton wasn't far, but the streets were too dangerous now, by daylight, with the police on Swain's side. But where could she hide, she asked. She had very little cash. The concept of currency, of coins and paper notes, was quaint and alien. Here, he said, as she rode a lift down to Holland Park. For the price of a ticket. The bulgy silver shapes of the trains, the soft old seats in gray and green, and warm, beautifully warm, another burrow, here in the realm of ceaseless movement.
Chapter 30. The Rip. The airport sucked a groggy Daniel Stark away, down a pastel corridor lined with reporters, cameras, augmented eyes, while Porfire and three Net security men swept Angie through the closing ring of journalists. A choreographed piece of ritual that had more to do with providing dramatic visuals than protection. Anyone present had already been cleared by security and the PR department. Then she was alone with Porfire in an express elevator, on their way to the heliport the Net maintained on the terminal's roof. As the doors opened into gusts of wet wind across brilliantly lit concrete, where a new trio of security men waited in giant fluorescent orange parkas, Angie remembered her first glimpse of the sprawl, when she'd ridden the train up from Washington with Turner. One of the orange parkas ushered them across an expanse of spotless concrete to the waiting helicopter, a large twin-prop Fokker, finished in black chrome. Porfire led the way up the spidery matte-black stairway. She followed without looking back. She had something now, a new determination. She decided to contact Hans Becker through his agent in Paris. Continuity had the number. It was time, time to make something happen. And she'd make something happen with Robin as well. He'd be waiting now, she knew, at the hotel. The helicopter told them to fasten their seatbelts. As they lifted off, there was virtual silence in the soundproofed cabin. Only a throbbing in the bones, and for a strange second, she seemed able to hold the whole of her life in mind. And know it. See it for what it had been. And it was this, she thought, that the dust had drifted over and concealed. And that had been freedom from pain.
and the sight of the soul's departure, said an iron voice out of candle glow in the roar of the hive.
Missy.
Poor Fire from the seat beside her leaning close.
I'm dreaming.
Something had been waiting for her years ago in the net. Nothing like the Loa, like Legba or the others, though Legba she knew was Lord of the Crossroads. He was synthesis, the cardinal point of magic, communication.
Poor Fire, she asked. Why did Bobby leave?
She looked out at the sprawl's tangled grid of light, at the domes picked out in red beacons, seeing instead the datascape that had drawn him, always back to what he'd believed was the only game worth playing.
If you don't know Missy, Poor Fire said, who does?
But you hear things. Everything, all the rumors. You always have.
Why ask me now?
It's time.
I remember talk, understand? How people who aren't famous talk about those who are. Maybe someone who claimed they knew Bobby talked to someone else and it came around. Bobby was worth talking about because he was with you, understand? That's a good place to start, Missy, because he wouldn't have found that so very gratifying, would he? Story was, he'd set out hustling on his own, but he'd found you instead. And you rolled higher and faster than anything he could have dreamed of. Took him up there, understand? With the kind of money he'd never even dreamed of back in Barrytown was just change.
Angie nodded, looking out over the sprawl. Talk was he had his own ambitions, Missy. Something driving him. Drove him off, finally. I didn't think he'd leave me, she said. When I first came to the sprawl, it was like being born. A new life. And he was there, right there, the very first night. Later, when Legba, when I was with the net.
When you were becoming Angie.
Yes. And as much of me as that took, I knew he'd be there. And also, that he'd never buy it entirely. And I needed that. How it was still just a scam to him, the whole business.
The net?
Angie Mitchell. He knew the difference between it and me.
Did he?
Maybe he was the difference. So high above the lines of light. The old New Suzuki Envoy had been Angie's favorite sprawl hotel since her earliest days with the net. It maintained its street wall for 11 stories, then narrowed jaggedly at the first of 9 setbacks into a mountainside assembled from bedrock excavated from its Madison Square building site. Original plans had called for this steep landscape to be planted with flora native to the Hudson Valley region and populated with suitable fauna. But subsequent construction of the first Manhattan Dome had made it necessary to hire a Paris-based eco-design team. The French ecologists, accustomed to the pure design problems posed by orbital systems, had despaired of the sprawl's particulate-laden atmosphere, opting for heavily engineered strains of vegetation and robotic fauna of the sort encountered in children's theme parks. But Angie's continued patronage had eventually lent the place a cachet it would otherwise have lacked. The net leased the 5 topmost floors where her permanent suite had been installed, and the Envoy had come to enjoy a certain belated reputation with artists and entertainers. Now she smiled as the helicopter rose past a disinterested robot bighorn pretending to munch lichen beside the illuminated waterfall. The absurdity of the place always delighted her. Even Bobby had enjoyed it. She glanced out at the Envoy's heliport, where the SenseNet logo had been freshly repainted on heated, floodlit concrete.
A lone figure, hooded in a bright orange parka, waited beside a sculpted outcropping of rock.
Robin will be here, won't he, poor fire?
Mr. Lanier, he said sourly.
She sighed. The black chrome Fokker brought them smoothly down, glasses tinkling gently in the drinks cabinet, as the landing gear met the roof of the Envoy. The muted throb of the engines died.
Where Robin is concerned, poor fire, I'll have to make the first move. I'm going to speak with him tonight. Alone. In the meantime, I want you to stay out of his way.
Poor fire's pleasure, missy, the hairdresser said,
as the cabin door opened behind them. And then he was twisting, clawing at the buckle of his seatbelt, and Angie turned in time to see the bright orange parka in the hatchway, the upraised arm, the mirrored glasses. The gun made no more sound than a cigarette lighter, but poor fire convulsed. One long black hand slapping at his throat, as the security man swung the hatch shut behind him and sprang at Angie. Something was clapped hard against her stomach as poor fire lolled back bonelessly in his seat, the sharp pink tip of his tongue protruding. She looked down in pure reflex and saw the black chrome buckle of her seatbelt through a sticky-looking lozenge of greenish plastic. She looked up into a white oval face framed by a tightly drawn orange nylon hood, saw her own face blank with shock, doubled in the silver lenses.
He drank tonight? What?
Him. A thumb jerked in poor fire's direction.
He drink any alcohol?
Yes, earlier.
Shit.
A woman's voice, as she turned to the unconscious hairdresser.
Now I've sedated him.
Don't want to suppress his breathing reflex, you know.
Angie watched as the woman checked poor fire's pulse.
I guess he's okay.
Did she shrug inside the orange parka?
Security?
What?
The glasses flashed.
Are you net security?
Fuck no, I'm abducting you.
You are?
You bet.
Why?
Not for any of the usual reasons.
Somebody's got it in for you.
Got it in for me, too. I was supposed to set it up to grab you next week.
Fuck 'em. Had to talk to you anyway.
You did.
Talk to me? Know anybody name of 3 Jane?
No, I mean yes, but... Save it. Our ass is out of here fast.
Poor fire. He's gonna wake up soon.
Look at him. I don't want to be around when he does.
Chapter 31 3 Jane. If this was part of Bobby's big gray house in the country, Slick decided, opening his eyes on the cramped curve of the narrow corridor, then it was a stranger place than it had seemed the first time. The air was thick and dead, and the light from the greenish glass tile ceiling strip made him feel like he was underwater. The tunnel was made of some kind of glazed concrete. It felt like jail.
Maybe we came out in the basement or something, he said, noticing the faint ping of echo off the concrete when he spoke.
No reason we'd cut into the construct you saw before, Gentry said. So what is it?
Slick touched the concrete wall. It was warm.
Doesn't matter, Gentry said.
Gentry started walking in the direction they were both facing. Past the curve, the floor became an uneven mosaic of shattered china, fragments pressed into something like epoxy, slippery under their boots.
Look at this stuff.
Thousands of different patterns and colors in the broken bits, but no overall design in how it had been put down, just random.
Art,
Gentry shrugged.
Somebody's hobby.
You should appreciate that, Slick Henry.
Whoever it was, they hadn't bothered with the walls. Slick knelt to run his fingers over it, feeling raw edges of broken ceramic, glassy, hardened plastic in between.
What's that supposed to mean, hobby? It's like those things you build, Slick. Your junk toys.
Gentry grinned his tense, crazy grin.
You don't know, Slick said. Spend your whole fucking life trying to figure what cyberspace is shaped like, man, and it probably isn't even shaped like anything. And anyway, who gives a shit?
There wasn't anything random about the judge and the others. The process was random, but the results had to conform to something inside, something he couldn't touch directly.
Come on, Gentry said.
Slick stayed where he was, looking up at Gentry's pale eyes, gray in this light, his taut face. Why did he put up with Gentry anyway? Because he needed somebody in the solitude. Not just for electricity. That whole landlord routine was really just a shuck. He guessed because you needed somebody around. Bird wasn't any good to talk to because there wasn't much he was interested in, and all he talked was Stringtown stupid. And even if Gentry never admitted it, Slick felt like Gentry understood about some things.
Yeah,
Slick said, getting up.
Let's go.
The tunnel wound in on itself like a gut. The section with the mosaic floor was back there now, around however many curves and up and down short curving stairwells. Slick kept trying to imagine a building that would have insides like this, but he couldn't. Gentry was walking fast, eyes narrowed, chewing on his lip. Slick thought the air was getting worse. Up another stairwell, they hit a straight stretch that narrowed to nothing in the distance, either way you looked. It was broader than the curved parts, and the floor was soft and humpy with little rugs. It looked like hundreds of them, rolled out layers deep over the concrete. Each rug had its own pattern and colors, lots of reds and blues, but all the patterns were the same zaggy diamonds and triangles. The dusty smell was thicker here, and Slick figured it had to be the rugs, they looked so old. The ones on top, nearest the center, were worn down to the weave in patches. A trail, like somebody'd been walking up and down there for years. Sections of the overhead light strip were dark, and others pulsed weakly.
Which way?
He asked Gentry. Gentry was looking down, working his thick lower lip between finger and thumb.
This way. How come? Because it doesn't matter.
It made Slick's legs tired, walking over those rugs. Had to watch not to snag his toes in the ones with holes worn through. Once he stepped over a glass tile that had fallen from the light strip. At regular intervals now, they were passing sections of wall that looked as though portals had been sealed over with more concrete. There wasn't anything there. Just the same arched shape and slightly paler concrete, with a slightly different texture.
Gentry, this has got to be underground, right? Like a basement under something.
But Gentry just brought his arm up, so that Slick bumped into it, and they both were standing there staring at the girl at the end of the corridor, not a dozen meters across the waves of carpet. She said something in a language Slick guessed was French. The voice was light and musical, the tone matter-of-fact. She smiled. Pale, under a twist of dark hair, a fine, high-boned face, strong, thin nose and wide mouth. Slick felt Gentry's arm trembling against his chest.
It's okay, he said, taking Gentry's arm and lowering it. We're just looking for Bobby.
Everyone's looking for Bobby, she said, English with an accent he didn't know. I'm looking for him myself.
for his body. Have you seen his body?
She took a step back, away from them, like she was about to run.
We won't hurt